I am the Solomonster, and this is the Solomonster Sounds Off.
I mean, look, seriously, you gotta see the woman's face here. Look at that. Look at that. They gotta picture her standing there for what felt like 45 seconds.
First sound off of 2022, my 15th year doing this podcast. This is episode 737 of the Solomonster Sounds Off for Sunday, January 2nd. WWE's nightmare scenario played out in real time last night. They lost their main event at the day one pay-per-view. Roman Reigns tested positive for COVID. Brock Lesnar is the new WWE champion. I've got the fallout from last night. It was the tale of two Tonys this week. Tony Storm telling WWE, you can take this job and shove it. And Tony Khan telling Big Swole, you suck, pal. After Swole dared to lob some criticism at her former employer. We're going to get into all of it. Plus, I've got the return date for Jon Moxley, the when and where that you can see him back in action. Predictions for NXT New Year's Evil and Wrestle Kingdom this Tuesday at the Tokyo Dome. And then we are counting down the 15 best wrestling matches of 2021 in rank order. What was the match of the year? Who was the wrestler of the year, both male and female? The moment of the year, the show of the year? I've got it all for you this week. There ain't no slacking off here to start the new year. No, sir. And I want to thank everybody for all the Happy New Year wishes on the stream the other night. Man, you guys came out in full force. And last night, too, during the day one stream. Seeing a lot of familiar faces in there, so that was very cool. Thank you for spending your new year, part of your new year anyway, with me. It was a lot of fun. We'll do it again at the end of this year. If you would like to support the podcast via PayPal, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You will see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. I do not believe there is a note field in there, so if you do want to submit a note of some kind with it, probably easier to just PayPalthesolomonster@gmail.com, or you can email me. You could always email me after the fact, but that is the place to go for that. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. This is our first PayPal roll call for 2022. These are our producers. You all get a producer credit, including Ms. Madness, Michelle Mills, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar, Big Bear Brian Becerra, West Coast James Herrera, and we've got Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Moldovan Masochist, Alexandru Mata, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, John Raging Mad Riffle, Caleb Showtime Lindley, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, Malevolent Michael Timoney, Kingmaker Christos Kalantzis, Postmaster Brian Blair, No Mercy Nick Horacek, Man of the Year Matt Oman, First Time Donator, what's going on, Matt? And speaking of first-time donators, we've got the option, Ben Bonzek. Happy New Year to Ben. Happy New Year to all of you. And then we also have Magnificent Mark Winsley, who has been busy finishing his grad degree and buying his first house. But he still always finds time to listen to the podcast each and every week. Happy New Year, Mark, and congratulations on the new home. We've got Vicious Valentino Volante. And I want to give Valentino a shout out here. Valentino also never misses an episode of the show, even though he watches very little, if any, of the current product. There's something I hear every single week. But over the last year, he started an online personal training business that specializes all aspects of physical performance, strength training, muscle building, weight loss, nutrition, injury rehab. And guess what? He's offering Sound Off listeners 20% off their first month to use any of his services. Just drop him a message on Instagram at Volante Strength and Fitness to get started, and you can arrange a free consultation call or visit VolanteStrengthAndFitness.com. That's V-O-L-A-N-T-E, Volante Fitness. VolanteStrengthAndFitness.com is the URL. You know, Valentino, he had a very promising judo career, and that came to an end when he was only 20 years old due to an injury. And now he has committed himself to helping others get strong and fit and to reach their goals, which I think is very noble. So again, VolanteStrengthAndFitness.com. And finally, we have the hairless potato, Ed Kiley, which is quite the name. Clearly, I didn't come up with it. That's all him. That's all Ed. That is the creativity of Ed. I will give him full credit for that. But he wanted to share that he used our promo link for BetterHelp.com, which is still valid. He used that promo link for their service over the past month, and he says it's fantastic. And that's something I've heard from a number of you. The offer is still good if you're looking for customized online therapy with licensed therapists that specialize all kinds of different areas, all sorts of problems you might be going through. Ed said he really wasn't clicking with the first therapist that he matched with, so he was given the option of choosing his own, which he did. And they've had some great conversations that have really helped him. And they even message him occasionally to see how he's doing, which is very cool. So use our link to get $10 off your first month when you use the link, BetterHelp.com/Solomonster. And thank you to Ed for that testimony. I love hearing stuff like that. Anytime somebody could take advantage of these offers, you know, through our sponsors and the people who, you know, advertise on the show and actually get some benefit out of it, whether it's a discount, whether it's just the service itself. I love hearing about stuff like that. Now, I can sit here and tell you that day one was the best WWE pay-per-view of the entire year. Of course, it was also the only WWE pay-per-view of the year so far. And no, it was not a very good show. But it had its moments. I would say an overall middle-of-the-road show. They were put in a very tough spot because they lost their main event. This was a one-match show going in, and they lost that one match. So you could not have envisioned, if you are Vince McMahon or any of the people behind the scenes in WWE, you could not have envisioned or hoped against a worse scenario than the one that played out for them last night in losing the biggest match on the entire show and the biggest storyline that's been going on in the company now for the past few months. And by the way, they're not called pay-per-views anymore. Oh no. They are called premium live events. That is the new term for these shows. That'll get over about as well as them trying to get people to call it sports entertainment. Good luck with that. Best matches on the show were the opener and the closer. Everything else was mid, as MJF would say. A very mid show. The main event was actually the shortest match on the entire show, and it had five people in it. It had five people in that match for the championship, and it was the shortest thing on the entire show, but it was all action, which is why I enjoyed it. I enjoyed that main event. But the big story, and the reason that that main event even went down the way it did, is because we found out yesterday, about 2 hours before the pay-per-view went on the air, at a time when people were already filing into the building and taking their seats in Atlanta. And around 6 o'clock in the evening yesterday came the news in the form of a press release and in the form of a tweet from the man himself that Roman Reigns, the biggest star in the entire company, the Universal Champion, was diagnosed with COVID-19. He tested positive for COVID. And the main event between him and Brock Lesnar was canceled. Obviously, Roman was not there. He is at home. He will be home for at least a couple of weeks, I'm sure. But he was off the show. The one person they could ill afford to lose to injury or illness was off the show. And Roman tweeted, I yearn to perform tonight at WWE Day 1 to defend my Universal Championship. However, earlier today I tested positive for COVID-19. Due to the proper protocols, I am unable to compete as originally scheduled. I look forward to returning to action as soon as possible. Those protocols that he refers to changed this past week when WWE decided that it would no longer require main roster talent to be COVID tested. I guess they're following in the footsteps of the NFL. Even though, you know, and it has to be mentioned here that Roman Reigns has been off the road, I believe, for about 2 weeks. Because they taped SmackDown for Christmas Eve, and then he didn't show at any of the live events this past week. He was one of many people who did not show up at some of the live events this past week as a precaution. But he has not been on the road with WWE for about 2 weeks, so it would not be something that he got from a WWE event, most likely. Even still, the optics of this are terrible, that they stopped testing and then a week later their biggest star test positive. And, you know, given his medical history, his two bouts with leukemia, he's at higher risk than most. I hope he gets well quickly. That's the most important thing. I think he'll be fine, but that's more important than any wrestling storyline or any wrestling belt or anything like that. So all the best to Roman. We need him back on TV as soon as possible. What do I say every week? If anything ever happens to Roman Reigns, oh boy, is this company in trouble. Well, here we are. So get well soon and get back on TV as soon as possible. So that left Brock Lesnar without an opponent. That left him without a match and anything to do. It was bad enough that the people who bought a ticket to go to the show already were not getting the champion. They were not getting Roman Reigns. You couldn't take Brock Lesnar off the show. You got to give him something to do. And what that was inserting Lesnar into the Fatal 4-Way to make it a Fatal 5-Way on the Raw brand for the WWE Championship. Brock is a free agent, as he pointed out again in a promo last night, thanks to his advocate, Paul Heyman. He can pretty much go wherever he wants and wrestle on whichever show he wants to wrestle on. So at least they had that built-in storyline explanation for why he would be inserted into a Raw match, even though we've been watching him on SmackDown now for weeks, ever since he came back. So it became a Fatal 5-Way, and Brock Lesnar is the new WWE champion. He pinned Big E to win the title. And boy, does this guy, he must have it out for the New Day. He must have it out for the New Day. Beating Kofi Kingston in about 8 seconds and took him about 8 minutes to do the same thing, win the same title from Big E. But this only happened because they wanted to give the fans something big. Because they lost their main event. That's what I believe. If Roman does not test positive and he's on that show last night and the Fatal 4-Way stays a Fatal 4-Way, then Big E this morning is still the WWE champion. So I believe the only reason we even got the title change on a few hours' notice, it's not like they had a lot of time to map this out, whatever their plans are going to be. The reason it happened is because they wanted to give the fans something special to close out the show. But as I've been saying, Big E was not going into WrestleMania as the champion anyway. So Brock has the belt. I saw a video of him taking selfies with fans around ringside after they went off the air. He seems like a totally different person. Ever since he came back and ever since we've gotten babyface Brock and he's smiling and he's been showing off more of his personality, he's cutting more of his own promos now that he doesn't have Paul Heyman with him. He is like a completely different person. It's been fun to watch. He still has that explosiveness. You piss him off, he's going to beat the hell out of you and throw you around. But him being able to kind of open up and come out of his shell and show more of his personality and his charisma that we saw, you know, quite a bit of in his original run in WWE. Don't forget Mariachi Brock from 2004 when he came out. That was during the feud with Eddie Guerrero before he put Eddie over and dropped the belt to him at No Way Out. So it's been nice to watch. I saw he was also at the hotel bar after the show with the belt. He was taking pictures with Wayne Gretzky and the TNT hockey crew. They all had big smiles on their faces. Just a couple of Canadians hanging out. So the key here, though, is that Brock Lesnar was inserted into a match that also included Bobby Lashley. You have heard me talk about this so many times over the years. Why haven't they done Lesnar against Lashley? It's the match that Lashley has wanted for so long. Why have they stayed away from this match for so many years? When are we going to get Brock Lesnar against Bobby Lashley one-on-one? Well, we didn't get Brock Lesnar against Bobby Lashley one-on-one, but we did get them in the same match. They did some spots together. And you'll notice Brock Lesnar, for all of the suplexes and all of the F5s and all of the destruction last night, did not get any offense, not a single offensive maneuver in on Bobby Lashley the entire match. That's the one guy that Brock did not touch and do anything to. He didn't give him a German suplex. He didn't give him an F5. He didn't do anything to him. They protected Lashley in there, and they did that for a reason. When the match was over, the camera lingered on Lashley in the aisleway, who was eyeballing Brock and giving him the stink eye. So this is not the last that we have seen of these two men. And there's so many different ways that you can go with this. This is not the end of the Roman Reigns, Brock Lesnar, Paul Heyman story, nor should it be. It's the best thing in the entire company. You can't just end it without there being some kind of a decisive conclusion, or if it's a swerve or whatever it is. This story is not over. But as I think about this, I love the idea of Paul Heyman reuniting with Brock, even if it's temporary, Paul Heyman reuniting with Brock, getting the two of them back together, and having Paul Heyman and MVP in dueling promo battles on television leading up to a singles match between Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley. That would be fantastic. But instead of WrestleMania, it's looking like we might be getting the match at the Royal Rumble. And so if you do the match at the Royal Rumble, then what do you do? If Brock is going to defend the WWE title, let's say, against Lashley at the Rumble, you know, what happens coming out of that? Now, I think you probably have the Bloodline and or Paul Heyman get involved in some way and cost Lesnar the championship. I could see Brock then entering himself later that night into the Royal Rumble match and winning it. Because if you think about potential winners of the men's Royal Rumble match, Brock Lesnar, even before what happened last night, Brock Lesnar had to be at or near the top of most people's lists as far as potential Rumble winners this year, just the way things were kind of shaping up. It could still happen. He could lose the title that night and then enter himself into the Rumble and win the entire thing, and that's how we get back on track with Lesnar against Reigns for the other title, the Universal title, at WrestleMania. Although they could tease things out a little bit, you know, maybe Brock, you know, is Brock going to pick Lashley and go back after Lashley? We all know, though, it would end up being Roman Reigns. So I don't know how much drama there would be in that decision. But that, to me, as I think of all the potential scenarios here, seems like it might be the likeliest scenario to play out. But keep in mind, we've got two nights of WrestleMania again. Maybe Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar each wrestle a match on night one against other opponents, with the winners meeting on night two. Maybe they do something like what New Japan is doing with their Wrestle Kingdom main events, but that seems a little too advanced for the way that WWE thinks about these kinds of things. And maybe, just maybe, they do a unification of the two top championships. We're getting one title unification in WWE this Tuesday on NXT with the North American title and the Cruiserweight title. We could get an even bigger kind of unification potentially at WrestleMania. Two titles, unified, one champion coming out of WrestleMania, and either have the traveling champion or just end the brand split once and for all. They've never been all that loyal to the concept anyway. That would seem to be the least likely of all of the potential scenarios. Knowing them, they would do Roman Reigns against Bill Goldberg, maybe on night one, with the winner facing the winner of Lesnar against Lashley then on night two, or something along those lines. Goldberg was just on Pat McAfee's show, and he said he's got one match left on his WWE deal. Now, he's also got a shoulder that needs surgery, but if he gets it, he's been putting it off for a while. He says if he gets the shoulder surgery, he's going to be out for a very long time. So he may be putting off the surgery until after he has that one last match. Now, they were supposed to do Roman against Goldberg 2 years ago before Reigns pulled out. That was at the beginning of the pandemic. If Drew McIntyre is suddenly out of the picture for WrestleMania with a neck injury, and I'm going to get to him in a second, and let's say they're short on top names to just sort of plug in there against him, it is not at all far-fetched that Vince McMahon gets the Goldberg versus Roman Reigns match that he has wanted to do. On at least night one, at least, of WrestleMania. It could very well happen. Becky Lynch is still the Raw Women's Champion. She beat Liv Morgan. I don't believe that it was ever about Liv Morgan. That's why I picked Becky to win in my predictions. And I said that she should win. It was the right outcome of the match. I know some people disagree with me, but it was the right outcome. This was never about Liv Morgan. I think it was about Becky Lynch having somebody to beat before she goes on to wrestle Bianca Belair at WrestleMania. Now, if I'm wrong, and the plan was to have Liv Morgan win, let's say, the Women's Royal Rumble match, and go, which I don't see happening, and go on to WrestleMania to get one last chance. That third match, one last chance against Becky Lynch, with the idea that Becky cheated in their first two matches. Well, that just went right out the window with that loss last night because of the botch at the end by Becky Lynch. Liv Morgan went for her finish. She went for the Oblivion in the ropes. Becky stopped her, hit a manhandle slam, went for the pin, and she was trying to get her foot on the bottom rope for added leverage. She was too far away. Her legs were too short. She couldn't reach the rope. So she pinned her. Clean. 1, 2, 3. There's no longer any need for a third match. She has now beaten this woman twice. Even Jimmy Smith on commentary, when they showed the replay, and it's not like they were shying away from it, they showed a replay of what happened, and Jimmy Smith said, no, it's a perfectly legal pin. So I don't see the point in going back to this again. I think the match of WrestleMania is Becky and Bianca. Could you work Liv in there and make it a triple threat? You could, but I think that's not the match to do. Edge against The Miz. Edge pinned The Miz. This was all about the return of Beth Phoenix with her very angry face. In the middle of this match, Maryse was getting involved left and right. She was trying to fuck Edge over left and right in this match. Out comes Beth Phoenix. She is standing in the aisleway. No music. Nothing. Camera pans over. We see her standing there. And she has a look on her face like she is trying to hold in the biggest shit that you could possibly imagine. She is just, she's trying with every fiber of her being and every muscle in her sphincter to hold it in. I mean, you should see the look on this woman's face. I mean, she's just standing there. She's not doing anything. And it felt like this was going on forever until finally Kevin Dunn decides to play her Glamazon music. And then she starts to make her way down to the ring. It's as if she was trapped in some kind of force field that was lifted the moment that they pushed play on her music. And then she started walking down to the ring. So that was kind of goofy. It was good to see her back. Very predictable. I think we all knew this is where this was leading to. I didn't know if she was going to be on the pay-per-view or not. Or, I'm sorry, the premium live event. This match played out exactly the way that I told you all it would. This was the most disappointing match that Edge has had since the WrestleMania match 2 years ago at Randy Orton. I thought that was way, way too long and pretty boring. And this was also a very boring match. This does not even hold a candle to any of the matches that Edge had last year. But it served the purpose, which was to set up the inevitable mixed tag match. When they decide to do it is the only question. Again, I don't see how they stretch this out to WrestleMania, but Edge could always go away. Could always put him out with an injury. 6 weeks later, he comes back, and it's time for WrestleMania. But there are lots of other matches I'd rather see him in on that show than a mixed tag match. Drew McIntyre was written off television. And this is even before I read about the injury update on him. The way that they did the backstage segment last night, after he beat Madcap Moss a little bit later on, Moss and Corbin attacked him in the back and they wrapped a chair around his neck and Corbin dropped this giant piece of, it's like a steel beam over the chair, and they seemingly were writing him off television for at least a couple of weeks. And we found out later that there is a legitimate injury issue with him. And that's the reason why they shot the angle and did what they did. Now, in WWE storylines, Drew McIntyre suffered a Cervical neck strain with severe contusions. Them and their fucking contusions. Upon further evaluation by medical staff, he will have a follow-up with an orthopedic cervical specialist. Per PW Insider, the word backstage is that this was done because McIntyre has been dealing with some legitimate neck issues of late for several weeks, and he is going to be undergoing further medical testing. There's no word on how long he will be out of action for. The hope among those that they have spoken with is that it will end up being a short-term in-ring hiatus. Who knows what that means? Short-term could be 2 weeks. Short-term could be, 4 weeks or 5 weeks. Maybe he misses the Royal Rumble. Until he gets checked out, we just don't know. But there were a lot of people over the course of the night who pointed out to PW Insider how insanely hard McIntyre has been going in recent weeks despite the neck issues, including him working multiple times a night over the recent live event tour, saw him doing tag matches against the Usos, and also some stiff street fights with Sheamus. And one person noted that McIntyre went down swinging to injury for the company. That does not sound good at all. I mean, anything with the neck does not sound good. The fact that he went down swinging, I don't know. I look at that as a very positive outlook for how this might turn out. And if they lose him going into WrestleMania when he may have been factored into the Universal title plans, that's another just heavy blow for them at a time when they can ill afford to have people high up on the card go down to injury or illness. I mean, they just can't afford for it to happen. They don't have enough people at the top. If they lose a whole bunch of people at once between now and then, they're in a lot of trouble. They had another injury on the show as well. Ridge Holland, who tagged with Sheamus on the kickoff show against Cesaro and Ricochet. Early in the match, Ricochet was flipped up into the air by his partner. Cesaro flipped him up. He was doing this standing 450, and he came down foot first right on Ridge's nose. And he broke his nose. It was pretty obvious that he probably broke his nose. Later on, they made it official. He did break his nose. He immediately checked out of the match. Sheamus went on to win anyway. And I think he's going to have to dust off his old face mask and give it to his buddy Ridge. But when we see Ridge back on TV, I don't know. That guy's had a string of bad luck with injuries, and if it's just a broken nose, he could be on TV and not wrestle. You know, again, maybe wear some kind of face mask. But that looked very gnarly. And we had a special announcement yesterday with regards to the Royal Rumble, and it came from Johnny Knoxville. 15 years to the day that Kevin Federline pinned John Cena on Monday Night Raw. A win, by the way, that Cena never did avenge. Johnny Knoxville here, 15 years later on New Year's Day, announced that he was training to be in this year's Royal Rumble match. And he said that he has been spending a lot of time over the holiday thinking about how he wanted to start off 2022, and he decided that he wants to kick ass and take names. And the best way to do that is to make a run for the Rumble. Training begins today. And he's got a movie coming out. They're coming out with another Jackass movie. Jackass Forever. Literally comes out a few days after the Royal Rumble. And the whole cast of the movie was on SmackDown. Or not SmackDown. It was on Raw. They were on Raw a few weeks ago. They did a little segment with RK-Bro in the back. So Johnny Knoxville is going to be in the Royal Rumble match. And as I said last night, I cannot muster up the energy to get too angry about this. There's a lot of things to get angry about and upset about. I don't have the energy to get angry over this because who cares? It doesn't even matter. You know, oh, he's taking up a spot from somebody. Who's he taking a spot from? Who would get Johnny Knoxville's spot that would get over in the Royal Rumble match? Give me a break. So if Johnny Knoxville goes in there, and if Brock Lesnar ends up in the Rumble and fucking throws this guy around, or if we get Walter making a Royal Rumble debut appearance here, and we can get one good Walter chop to Johnny Knoxville, then it would be all worth it. As long as one of those two scenarios plays itself out, I don't really care. It's fine with me. They have bigger issues with the Royal Rumble on the women's side. They don't have enough women. They don't even have 30 women on the roster, so usually they call up a few names from NXT. you look at the state of these women's divisions right now. They're going to have to call up a lot of faces from NXT. It's going to be a struggle, I think, to fill up that Women's Rumble match this year. On Wednesday, Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful broke the news that Toni Storm was gone from WWE, only days after wrestling Charlotte Flair for the SmackDown Women's title on Christmas Eve. Not that she had been released, only that she had left the company. And we have since learned that she quit. She walked out. She quite literally took her ball and flew herself home. This was said to be a decision that she made on her own without telling anybody. She flew herself home from Baltimore the morning after she took part in a triple threat match against Charlotte and Sasha Banks at a live event in Washington, D.C. Another story going around, per The Observer, is that she was never booked for D.C., and it was a last-minute thing with her being told at 8 o'clock that morning that she would be needed there. And professional burnout is another reason that has been cited for her leaving. She has not commented on this publicly, so until she does, we don't know for sure 100%, but that is the story going around. Cassidy Haynes of BodySlam.net said that he asked around and said that it was told to him she just up and quit, worked the triple threat, and then paid out of her own pocket to fly herself home, which I don't know why that would even be relevant. If she quit and she chose to go home, I'm not sure why WWE would be responsible for paying her way, if that's sort of the inference there. But one female WWE talent said, "It's fucking wild. She's just gone. Didn't really tell anyone." Her quitting the way that she did, I assume that means she'll be held to the same 90-day non-compete as every other main roster member who leaves or gets released before their contract is up. But we don't know for sure. You know, it's not as if they haven't played games with people before. They could do the same here if she tries to go somewhere else and she, you know, they say that she still has time on her contract. We just don't have all the details right now. We don't know. We don't know what we don't know. What we do know is that Toni Storm had every right to be upset with the way that she has been booked ever since she got called up back in July. And I say that despite the fact that this woman was challenging for the championship on TV 9 days ago. I'm well aware of the fact that she was on television wrestling for the SmackDown Women's Championship 9 days ago. That does not excuse everything that came before it. And now, the lasting image of Toni Storm on WWE television will be her, after losing, sitting in the ring and crying. July 23rd. That is the day that Toni Storm made her SmackDown debut with a win over Zelina Vega. And then, we didn't see her again until September. She did an interview with Ryan Satin that dropped 2 days before she walked out on the company. 2 days! 48 hours! Before all of this happened, this interview came out. Sit-down interview on YouTube. Talking about how sitting backstage and catering during that time, what a mind fuck it was. She didn't use those words, but basically that's what she was saying, what a mind fuck it was. To just sit there waiting for something, waiting for any kind of guidance, waiting for her big break, waiting to show the world what she's worked her entire life for, and not having any idea what was going on because nobody was telling her anything. So then she finally reappears, not for a match, but for an angle, where Dolph Ziggler was hitting on her in the back. That, too, went nowhere. Then she lost to Zelina Vega in 2 minutes in the opening round of the Queen's Crown. And then they program her with Charlotte Flair. And we all know how that went. She took two pies to the face, uncontested. Just stood there and did nothing about it but pout. Two pies to the face. Then she pied Charlotte in the face. This is how they built up this SmackDown Women's Championship match, by the way, for Christmas Eve, the one that Toni lost. By having a pie-throwing contest. This is how they built this match up. Now, she lost, and she had no reason to win anyway. I didn't expect her to win, and she didn't deserve to win. What did she do up to that point that would have made anybody think she would actually win the championship? But she lost, And then she sat in the ring and she cried about it. And her standing there with pie frosting all over her face will now define her entire WWE main roster run. Like Karrion Kross in that stupid mask. When people think about what they did to Karrion Kross on Monday Night Raw, and they think, what image comes to mind? When you think of Karrion Kross and his run on the main roster, I guarantee you the majority of people are going to think of that stupid mask. That ridiculous mask. And when people think of Toni Storm, they're going to, in their mind, they're going to have that image of her with the white frosting all over her face, with the little pouty look on her face. You can make a whole wall of shame with all of these people and a lot of the NXT call-ups who have come up and gotten their legs cut off and their balls cut off and then inevitably get released or they quit. Whatever happens, they leave the company. You could put their pictures up on a wall. It's like, you know, some of these police shows, these cop shows where they have the board and they pin up the photos of the different suspects and everything. You can put a whole wall of headshots up with all of these different images of all these people. Keith Lee in the gear with the fucking cat claws, you know, bear claw, roar, roar, bear claw. Like, you can have all these images. Toni Storm is now up on the wall. She's up on the wall of shame in WWE. Now, by all accounts, she is the one who asked for her release, not the other way around. We still don't know if there's anything else that may be going on in her personal life that factored into her decision. Maybe it's more than just burnout. But the fact is, if Toni Storm is in a good place in her life mentally, if she's in a good place in her career with how things are going in WWE, if she's happy, then she doesn't just up and leave. If the brain trust in that company isn't brain damaged, then this does not happen. This ain't the first time, and this damn sure won't be the last time that an NXT star has their legs cut out from under them on their maiden voyage to Looney Land. And I said this on Wednesday, if you honestly believe that WWE did right by this woman in those 5 months since she was called up, you are a clueless idiot. You are a stooge. Mo, Larry, Curly, and you. I applaud her. You know, WWE fired 80 talents last year. This time, she didn't give them the chance. Because it was inevitable that that's likely what would have ended up happening to her this year anyway. They fired over 80 people last year on that roster. She did not even give them the chance. She turned around and fired them. She wished them well in their future endeavors. Good for her. Now, legally, things may get a little dicey. If she wants to go wrestle somewhere else and WWE says, hey, you breached your contract, you still have to fulfill your obligations to us, that then gets into the whole independent contractor debate. I don't know that that's a fight that she wants to take on herself. I'm very curious if she was actually granted her release or not. I still see a lot of very wishy-washy language on, did she get her release after asking for it? Did she even ask for it? Doesn't sound like she even asked for it. You know, we still don't know for sure exactly what her official status is. You know, or do they end up working things out and she comes crawling back because they're not going to allow her to go work for AEW or some other promotion because she has however much time left on her contract. It could be months, it could be years. We don't know. Because when you sign a contract, you are agreeing to work for them for a set period of time. But we just heard story after story in 2020 and 2021 of wrestlers signing 3-year deals, 5-year deals with WWE, and then 6 months later, they're cut. All the power is in their hands. The talent has none. So that when a certain talent turns to them and says, I'm out of here, either this is too damaging to my career, or I just can't handle the travel and the stress, or, you know, being away from my fiance because, you know, she's engaged to Juice Robinson. Whatever it is, when that happens, I don't have any sympathy for WWE at all. And I hope she isn't gone for long and she goes somewhere that allows her to be Toni Storm and not their version of what they want Toni Storm to be. You know, the woman is 26 years old. She's got all the tools to be a major star wherever she lands. If that does happen to be AEW, the timing could not be any better with them introducing a second women's championship. They're literally crowning a second women's champion in a matter of days. The timing could not be any better if she was to pop up on their show in the next 6 months. Wherever she goes, I guarantee you one thing. I guarantee you that she will be treated with more respect than WWE gave her over these last 5 months. Speaking of AEW, they were not without controversy of their own this week, much of it of their president's own making. Big Swole and Tony Khan. We have to talk about this situation, and I addressed it on Friday night, actually during the New Year's Eve stream, because this literally all went down and broke on social media about, 2 hours or so, 2-3 hours before I went live. And, you know, it's a touchy subject. It deals with issues of race and diversity, but it's not just a race thing. I mean, there was a lot to unpack with what Big Swole talked about on her show. So Big Swole announced on November 30th that she and AEW had mutually parted ways. And Big Swole has a podcast of her own called Swole World. Was not aware of this until a few days ago. And she talked about the decision to mutually part ways with AEW. And this is courtesy of Fightful.com. She talked about the most emotional moment that she had in AEW was when Kenny Omega thanked her for what she did in the Diamante feud and how it made other women in the company more comfortable to pitch ideas behind the scenes. And she said that she explained to Tony Khan that I didn't want to re-sign because my peace was being disrupted. If anybody knows me, if anything is disrupting your peace, it's time to let it go. And the stuff with Kenny is interesting because she also talked about butting heads with him and having issues with him before behind the scenes. Maybe creative differences, I don't know. But she said, my heart just stopped being in it as the reason why I left AEW. I felt like there were a lot of things, and I told them in my exit interview there were a lot of things that need to change. I know fans of the company don't take criticism well sometimes. Certain ones. You don't say. By the way, that applies to both sides, WWE and AEW. I encounter them on a daily basis, on an hourly basis. I see and hear from these very same people. You say the slightest thing out of turn about either product and they lose their fucking minds because they are they're out of their own minds. They don't have a mind to lose. So I can relate to that. But she says, know this from somebody on the inside. The structure is a little off. It's fine to be loose, but I like to have a little bit more structure. I felt like the women should not have gone through everything they went through just to get on TV or get time. You're signed to this big company, you should get time. All these men are getting time, but the women were not getting anything, or you're not putting people on TV because more people are coming in. Okay, there are more people coming in, but you don't have enough product for all of these people. Now you have all these people sitting around having 2 or 3 minute matches on Dark. That doesn't keep me happy. Shoveling more money does not keep a person happy. And that's another criticism that we have heard. And AEW is still bringing in new faces every month. We just had Kyle O'Reilly make his debut. There's still a lot of talk about maybe Johnny Gargano. Maybe Bray Wyatt at some point this year makes his way in. Other talent. I mean, maybe that forbidden door cracks open a little bit more. We see more New Japan names come over and make appearances on AEW television. And, you know, we've talked about how that has to be frustrating. And at some point, it's going to reach a boiling point. You're going to have people who want to leave. Instead of it being a one-way street where people leave WWE and go to AEW, you will have AEW people that eventually leave and end up going over to the other side. Because they also are very frustrated about sitting around and catering and sitting around and not having anything to do or going out there and having 2 minute matches on the YouTube show. You can understand why that would be frustrating to people. But she said outside of the lack of structure, their biggest issue is diversity. I don't beat around the bush when it comes to diversity and my people. There is no representation, truly, and when there is, it does not come across in the black community as genuine at all. I don't know why anybody is so afraid to accept it or say it, but that is not a good look. I knew something was up when my daughter, who loves watching wrestling, when she made the comment to Big Swole that when she watches AEW, she doesn't see anybody who looks like her. There's nobody that looks like Daddy. Daddy is Cedric Alexander, for those who don't know. Then she started watching WWE because she saw Bianca and Big E. She saw herself represented. If that wasn't a click, you are absolutely right. I don't have an explanation. It's 2021. Why are people saying it'll take 3 years for AEW to have a black champion? This is a scripted sport. It should not take that long if you have been watching WWE for 50 years. So it sounds like there what she's kind of getting into is the idea that she's upset there's no black world champion in AEW. I guess either with the women or the men. Now you're getting into the issue of this issue of diversity or a lack thereof that some people think exists in AEW. And clearly that is what ruffled the feathers of Tony Khan. And there's more to what she said. I'm not going to read all of it, but she made it a point that diversity is an issue in AEW, in her mind. And the stuff with Kenny Omega, you know, her issue was the women's division sort of fell by the wayside when Kenny Omega was really starting to get busy working on his own stuff. And she talked about the female talent only, again, wrestling 2-minute matches on Dark with inexperienced young talent. She said at one point she was taken aside by somebody and asked to be a sheriff of sorts in the division and handle any issues that may come up. She says that she and others made suggestions to try to make the division better, like training camps and guest instructors. Many in the division would pitch storylines and wouldn't get any feedback. And so that caused a lot of frustration as well. Tony Khan, though, chimed in on this. He couldn't let sleeping dogs lie. He had to respond. And Tony Khan wins for sad tweet this week. He saw the Fightful write-up on Big Swole's comments, and he quote tweeted their tweet with one of his own. This was only a few hours before their big New Year's Eve edition of Rampage. I heard a lot of great things about the women's match on that show with Ty Conti and Anna Jay against The Bunny and Penelope Ford, and there was a Cody TNT title match. So he didn't have to say anything about this on New Year's Eve. He could have left it alone and responded in a different way on a different day. But he couldn't help himself. And he went, and now Fightful, I should mention, Fightful reported previously that AEW are the ones who did not renew Big Swole's deal. She paints it as this mutual decision. I didn't want to stay, and I let them know about my decision. But, you know, you read this, and it's almost as if she made the call to leave. And that does not sound like, you know, the full truth. I guess both things could be true. But Tony Khan made the decision a lot easier for her because apparently he had no interest in re-signing her to begin with. This is what he said. The top two AEW executives are brown. Me and Mega, who is the SVP and Chief Legal Officer for the Jacksonville Jaguars, and she works for AEW as well. Jade, Bowens, Caster, Dante, Nyla, Isaiah, and Marquen all won on TV this month. TBS title tournament has been very diverse. I let Swole's contract expire as I felt her wrestling wasn't good enough. Hashtag AEW Rampage, street fight tonight. Got to get that little bit of promotion in there right at the very end. Street fight tonight. If Tony Khan was upset by what Big Swole had to say and disagreed with it, there is a right way to respond to it. This was not that way. He's trying to be Dana White. Dana White can be Dana White because that's just who he is, and he always comes off like an asshole whenever he talks. Tony Khan has built up all of this goodwill with his audience and a lot of wrestling fans and the way that he, you know, handles things and you know, bringing in all of this talent and putting together a lot of these dream matches that people have been talking about and trying to be the anti-WWE. He has built up all of the, and has been trying to build up all of this goodwill. And then he goes out and he responds and reacts in the way that he did. The Dana White look is not a good look for Tony Khan. This was the worst possible way to respond to this, because what he did was turn it into a gigantic story that has been trending ever since. And it's all anybody was talking about is how poorly he came off. And it turned into a debate about Tony Khan. Was he right? Was he wrong to say what he did in the way that he did? You know, him saying that Big Swole as a wrestler wasn't very good and her skills were not up to snuff is perfectly fine if that's how he feels. And there's probably a way for him to say it maybe in a different forum where it doesn't come off like he's just being a fucking asshole. Big Swole was not the best in that women's division. Not even close. And Tony obviously felt the same way, except in that media scrum after the Revolution pay-per-view last March, he said the exact opposite. He said Big Swole is a great wrestler and has a great personality. She's gotten better, he said. She's had a lot of great matches, he said. I don't know what those matches are, but that's what he said at the time. So evidently, something changed in the 7 months that followed. Let's say he changed his mind and feels the opposite now. Maybe he felt she wasn't progressing enough. Let's just say. He's got to recognize that this woman is addressing some issues that are important to her, and if she feels that way, there's a pretty damn good chance there are other people in that company who feel the same way. Now, they may not feel as comfortable as she is going out and talking about it publicly, especially if they're still under contract and she's not. She's free, so she's got nothing to worry about now. She can pretty much say whatever she wants without fear of, you know, it blowing back on her. But you have to imagine that there are probably at least a few other people, if not maybe several people, who work for Tony Khan, who might feel the same way. She might not be the only one. She is relaying her experiences in the company. If she feels there is a lack of structure behind the scenes, that's a perfectly valid critique. All this does, the way that he responded and sticking that last line in there, is make him come off like he's just dismissing everything that she just said. We've got lots of diversity. She sucked in the ring, and don't forget to watch Rampage tonight. What he did is potentially piss off a whole bunch of people who work for him. And Leo Rush was one of those people. He was very upset. He called on Tony Khan to apologize. Now, Tony Khan does not have to apologize for thinking that Big Swole sucks as a wrestler, if that's how he feels. But again, it feels like he just threw that jab in there because somebody criticized him and he got very defensive. And it's not the first time that we have seen him react in a very defensive way to criticism. There was an article on the Fox website, either Fox or FoxNews.com, whatever it was, that made mention, I think, of it might have been the Jaguars and some of the Khan family like sports entities that lumped AEW in there, and I think either the insinuation or what was said was that their ratings are down. And so it's this random writer on a website talking about this, and Tony Khan came back at Fox News, at Fox News, he tagged him on Twitter, and he came back with like 4 Nielsen charts with demos and numbers, and it's like, what are you doing? None of this is necessary at all. You're giving a voice to these outlets that's just going to amplify them. If you think they're wrong and you don't like what they're saying, the best thing that you could do is just leave it alone. Or wait until you're on Sirius. He's got a spot every single week, at least one day a week, I know. I think every Wednesday, right? Is it Wednesday or Friday? He's on Busted Open Radio. Right? Don't they call it like Tony Time or something? I mean, he's got a forum. There's a time and a place where he can address these. And this is the problem a lot of people get into when they try to tweet stuff out in a very limited number of characters. It's very hard sometimes to get your point across. And it's why there's a lot of stuff I wait until the Sunday podcast to talk about. There are things I'd love to go and tweet about when news breaks during the week. And I sometimes have to pull myself back and say, I can't say what I want to say in 240 characters. Or I'll say it and it'll come across wrong. I'll wait until Sunday and I'll speak it. I'll be able to better articulate what I'm trying to say. People will hear my voice and the way that I'm talking about it, and that can make all the difference in the world. Things sometimes on social media, they just get lost in translation. There was no good reason for him to go off half-cocked the way that he did. It was a no-win situation for him. And it completely overshadowed whatever points, valid points, he was trying to make. And it took attention away from that very violent, very bloody street fight on Rampage. Because those four women went in there and they fucking worked their asses off. And I thought that was very unfair to them. Now, the next day, Leo Rush posted a follow-up statement saying that he and Tony Khan had spoken privately. This is what he had to say. I want this to be clear. I do not consider this to be a diversity issue. And I at no point have thought or said that AEW or Tony are racist. We could all clearly see that wrestling as a whole and the AEW roster is perpetually diverse. The issue at hand was a racial insensitivity issue. Having spoken to Tony and Mega, we have discussed the endeavors to further understand the struggles of the black community. I am grateful to be able to understand more about Tony and Mega, their own ethnic backgrounds, and glad that they are actively seeking input from an African-American perspective. I am proud to work for a boss and company that try to make these strides in social equality. I look forward to working with Tony to keep making steps towards positive change. I pray that 2022 is a year of positive change in all aspects. So they got together privately, which is how this probably should have been dealt with in the first place. They got together privately and hashed it out, and that's good. He had to do something. The last thing you want is a small rebellion in your locker room. Because the one thing AEW has going for it, it seems, is that they have a pretty harmonious locker room. I mean, there could be underlying issues that we're not aware of, and I'm sure there's always issues. But, you know, you hear about what a family it is and what a loose environment it is, and people can express themselves creatively, and people are just generally happier. The people who have jumped from WWE to AEW seem to like the environment and the atmosphere a lot more. The last thing you want to do is fuck with that. So Tony Khan, as the head of this company, had to do something to put this shit to bed. But it's a mess that he caused himself. It's not Big Swole's fault. Big Swole was well within her rights to go on her show and say the things that she said. She doesn't work for them anymore. It's her podcast. And I wouldn't want anybody telling me what I can and can't talk about on my podcast, because the first thing I would say to them is go fuck yourself. So the issue is not in what Swole said, that she didn't have the right to say it. She absolutely does. The issue that I can understand Tony being upset about is this idea that AEW is not diverse. They are absolutely diverse. There are a lot of talents from a lot of different backgrounds who look different in many ways, who come from different ethnic backgrounds, people of all races and nationalities that have had roles on television and been champions in that company. You know, maybe Big Swole is upset that there hasn't been a black world champion yet in AEW. I think in time there will be, I'm sure. But right now, the stars are the ones who are in those positions. And I look ahead in the year 2022 and I see people like MJF and I see people like Malakai Black and even people like Bryan Danielson and CM Punk. Those are the people who are going to be in that spot. Wardlow is another one who I think is going to explode as a babyface onto the scene in 2022. And I wouldn't want anybody saying, oh, well, you know, Wardlow shouldn't get the spot because he's white. To me, it's, you know, when it comes to who's the world champion in AEW or in WWE, it shouldn't be about who's black and who's white, who looks like this, who looks like that. It's giving those people opportunities to succeed and to get themselves over. And if they get over at that level, then by all means, put the belt on them like they did with Big E. Now, Big E ended up having a very uneventful run in WWE, and that wasn't really entirely his fault. But Big E is somebody who I was waiting a long time for him to get that big push. And I was very happy when he won the Money in the Bank and he went on and he won the championship. It's not the way that I would have done it, but he did go on to become WWE champion. Look at Bobby Lashley. Look at the year that Bobby Lashley had. He had the best year of his entire life. He's been around for a while. And finally, they figured out what to do with Bobby Lashley. The guy's a fucking destroyer. He's also a freak athlete. He's already in his mid to late 40s, but he's doing the best work of his career. That man is a world champion. He's been a world champion. He will be a world champion again because he earned it. Now in AEW, they have people like a powerhouse Hobbs who I think one day may get to that level. He ain't there yet. And I don't want him there just because of the way that he looks. I want him there when the time is right for him to be a world champion. So I don't have any issue with people like Kenny Omega and Hangman Page or MJF if he gets the belt next being a champion. Those are the people right now at this moment who should be in those spots. There's a lot of young talent also being promoted in that company. And a lot of really quality African-American talent as well, who I think one day are going to become big stars. It's not just about Jungle Boy and Darby Allin. You've got people like Dante Martin and Powerhouse Hobbs. And clearly they see things in people like Lee Moriarty and Lee Johnson. Jade Cargill may be the TBS champion in the next few days. She is absolutely a star. The first day I looked at that woman, I said, this woman is a fucking star. That's the kind of person that I'm sure AEW would love to at some point build their women's division around. Now, she's still very green and inexperienced, but she'll get there. I don't even know that I would put the belt on her this week. I'd rather go on Ruby Soho, but if not this week, she will get there. But Tony Khan getting upset because somebody says the company is not diverse enough, you know what? He has a right to be upset about that because I think that is an unfair criticism. But that's how she feels. And he just, in one line, he completely negated all of that other stuff by putting the line in there about how I don't think she's a very good wrestler. It doesn't matter if it's true. You have to be smart enough in the position that he's in to know when to shut up and when to walk away, when the time is right and when the time is not right to make a comment like that. He shot himself in the foot. It was an unforced error. It didn't have to happen. And so he had a very shitty start to his new year. Because he was trending online for all the wrong reasons. And believe me, these people care a lot about not just the demos, but trending and all that stuff. That is not the way that he envisioned spending his New Year's Eve. On Dynamite on Wednesday, Jim Ross made his return to the announce booth. This was their homecoming at Daly's Place in Jacksonville, where he now has a home. Jim Ross is now cancer-free. He went through almost 24 radiation treatments for skin cancer. He announced that day that he is cancer-free, which is great news, but also thoughts to Don West, who is not cancer-free anymore. He was diagnosed with brain lymphoma earlier this year. He underwent treatment. He was in remission as of September, and then Jeff Jarrett, on his behalf, made the announcement the other day on social media that Don is back in the hospital being treated for what I assume is a recurrence of the same cancer. So he's having a tough time, and so positive vibes to Don West. Guy is full of positivity all the time. Every time I would see, he's always in sell mode, right? He's such a great pitch man, such a great sell. Selling is sort of his forte. But he always had a smile on his face, and he was always full of energy. And I hate to think that, you know, he's going through all this shit right now again after thinking that he had gotten over it. So happy to hear about Jim Ross, not so much about Don West. Jade Cargill beat Thunder Rosa to advance in the TBS title tournament with an assist from the debuting Mercedes Martinez, who is now officially all elite. She has made one appearance before in a battle royal for AEW, but was not signed. In fact, she decided after that to go to WWE. And then she dodged a big bullet with the retribution stuff and specifically asking to go back to NXT, so she didn't have to be part of any of that nonsense. And now she is in AEW, and yeah, she's one of those veteran presence, I think kind of like a Serena Deeb, who could probably be as useful, if not more useful, behind the scenes and helping out the other women and the less experienced women in that division than anything else that she might be doing on TV. So I think that's really where her value could be for them. Also, more seeds of discord planted with the Young Bucks, Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly. O'Reilly wrestling his first match in the main event. It was Cole, Fish, and O'Reilly tagging together in that main event against Orange Cassidy and the Best Friends. And the Bucks come in and causing all kinds of problems and pointing the finger at Kyle, who accidentally booted Cole in the head. And so again, they're taking their time playing this out until Kenny Omega is ready to come back. I'm telling you, that's exactly where this is going. Buying time until Kenny is ready to come back, and then things are going to explode. 3-on-3. We're going to get these two warring factions. Now, this Wednesday, Dynamite debuts on TBS. It is the first TBS show. We have Adam Page defending the AEW World Championship against Bryan Danielson. It is the rematch. If they go the full 60 minutes again, which they won't, the title will be decided by three judges who have not yet been named, although I have already pitched the name Bret Hart. There's your first Bret Hart mention here on the first podcast of the new year. I've already pitched his name to be a judge. Penta and Rey Fénix defend the AEW Tag Team titles against Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus. Jade Cargill against Ruby Soho in the finals of the TBS title tournament. And Malakai Black one-on-one against Brian Pillman Jr. We now know when the former AEW World Champion Jon Moxley is going to be making his way back to the ring after checking himself into inpatient rehab for alcohol addiction just before the Full Gear pay-per-view in November. This past Saturday, Homicide won the Do or Die Rumble at the GCW show to earn a shot at Jon Moxley's GCW World Championship. He is still the GCW World Champion. He beat Nick Gage for it a few months ago. And then came the announcement that Moxley will defend the title against Homicide January 23rd at their Hammerstein Ballroom debut in New York City. So I don't know if he might appear on AEW television before then. You know, is it a case where he's ready to come back now? And maybe he'll be on the first TBS show this Wednesday? Possible. We may see him in a few days, but so far the only thing that's been announced for him is the GCW date on the 23rd. I would think that Tony Khan would want Jon Moxley's first big appearance back to be on an AEW show. So if I were a betting man, I would say that either Moxley makes a surprise appearance this Wednesday on the first TBS show, or on that first TBS show, they make the announcement that Jon Moxley is on his way back. And then he shows up on Dynamite the following week. It would surprise me if they gave that away to GCW before he shows up in AEW. AEW should get first priority on something like that. You know, he's an AEW talent, first and foremost. And it's great that AEW does allow a lot of these talents to kind of book their own dates outside. WWE doesn't do that. But if I'm Tony Khan, I want Jon Moxley to make his first appearance on my show, not on the GCW show. And this last nugget here, I had to mention this. On his Talk is Jericho podcast recently, Chris Jericho talked about his death match against Nick Gage on Dynamite last summer. That was when MJF was making Jericho do the five labors to get a match with him. Jericho said that he believes the match against Nick Gage deserved a 5-star rating. Yes, this is what he really said. He said, "We did the match with Nick Gage and came up with all the cool spots that you saw. One of my favorite matches. You talk about a 5-star match. I don't know if there's such a thing as a 5-star death match. Of course, there should be, and of course, there is. In my opinion, it was a 4.5 to 5-star match. If I were doing an addendum to my List of Jericho book, I would put it in there as 4.5 stars or 5 stars. I've never had a full-fledged death match before. I'll never have another one again. But that night, we had a great one." Jericho must have gotten into the bubbly a little early for New Year's Eve if he thinks that was a 5-star match. I mean, I know Meltzer broke the scale with those 6- and 7-star ratings, and now it's just ridiculous now. But boy, has the bar been lowered for what a 5-star wrestling match is. Someone needs to pry that bottle of Grey Goose out of his hands for his own good. NXT, this week coming up, we have New Year's Evil. And I will give you my predictions here in a second, but none of the matches they advertised for this past week's NXT show actually ended up happening. And I assume it was entirely due to COVID-related issues. You know, WWE keeps things close to the vest, so they don't tell us a fucking thing. I was shocked they even told us Roman Reigns had COVID. I thought they would try to cover it up and try to tell us that he fell down a fucking manhole or something, and they were still trying to dig him out. When Michael Cole uttered the words COVID-19 on the show, I was shocked. But Dexter Lumis was supposed to wrestle Grayson Waller. He wasn't there. Brian Kendrick was supposed to wrestle Harland, and he wasn't there. Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, the women's tag team champions, Toxic Attraction, they were supposed to wrestle Raquel Gonzalez and Cora Jade, and they weren't there. So Grayson Waller instead beat Odyssey Jones, who we haven't seen on TV in a while. And AJ Styles then appeared on the Tron. He said he would see Waller at New Year's Evil. They're being very vague about what this is. They have not said that this is a match. Only that AJ is coming to confront him. He's coming to pay him a visit. It's like going to grandma's house. People pay their grandmother a visit. They don't go to their grandmother's house to beat her in a match. So it doesn't appear they're actually having a match, or else they would say that they're having a match. Riddle. Matt Riddle was supposed to be in the flesh, in the 2.0 zone, with MSK to confront Imperium, and Riddle was not there. Instead, he appeared on the Tron, because as he said, plans change. I wonder if people will get as angry with him for saying that as they do whenever Dave Meltzer says it. Probably not. So we had dueling promos here from MSK, and Imperium came out in the aisleway, and Walter, much like Riddle, Walter appeared up on the Tron. And Riddle challenged them to a trios match for New Year's Evil, which Walter accepted. So that's very cool. We're going to get Matt Riddle and MSK against Walter and the tag team champions Imperium. I said there was no Brian Kendrick, who got thrown down a flight of stairs a few weeks ago by Harland, Joe Gacy's monster. So they were going to do a match this week. Kendrick was not there. Harland instead defeated Andre Chase. Right up until the commercial break before the match, they were still promoting an appearance by Kendrick. So they pulled the old bait and switch here. And then we had the in-ring debut of Tiffany Stratton against Fallon Hanley. Stratton hit her with the Dana Brooke flipping elbow spot, and she kind of botched it, and she got booed, some boos for it. And then she finished off Hanley with a flatliner. This was not very good. This was not very good. And like Lash Legend, she looks like a great athlete, but she has no business being in matches yet on television. But part of the problem is that NXT has not gone back to running live events. They haven't run any live events since early 2020. They used to do those local loops in Florida. They haven't done shit. So the only way to get her and get these people who have no experience, performing in front of actual fans is to put them on the TV show because they don't have any live events. But, she looks completely miscast to me in this gimmick. She's an Olympian, I think. I think she's an Olympian. She's like a bodybuilder. But she's also this spoiled rich brat who talks about her daddy's money. It's just more gimmicky bullshit. Everybody has to have a gimmick on this show. As a first appearance, though, I didn't think this was really any good at all. They had a contract signing for the unification match in New Year's Evil with Roderick Strong and Carmelo Hayes. Roddy was out there with the members of Diamond Mine. Carmelo Hayes came out with Trick Williams. There was a big table in the ring, and Wade Barrett was the moderator. And Malcolm Bivens, I love Malcolm Bivens. Malcolm Bivens is fucking great. He's out there with Diamond Mine, and Trick Williams begins to cut a promo, and Bivens had to translate what Trick Williams was saying. And I thought Malcolm Bivens was great here. He was hilarious. So eventually things got more serious, and Strong was cutting a promo on Hayes. Hayes was cutting a promo on Roddy. And at the end of the segment, Williams got up in Bivens' face, and the Creed brothers picked up Trick Williams, and they put him through the table with a spinebuster. In the match preview on WWE.com, they are referring to the new title, this unified championship, as the NXT North American Cruiserweight title, which sounds absolutely ridiculous. Kind of just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? The NXT North American Cruiserweight title. First of all, it makes no sense to keep calling it a cruiserweight title if anybody can compete for it, so that's stupid. I assume this is just temporary. I assume this is just a placeholder thing until after the match, and then it will simply be the North American title, because otherwise, then this is just fucking stupid. Solo Sikoa got a win over Santos Escobar. It was the best match on the show. This stuff they're doing with Zion Quinn and Electra Lopez, it's like this love storyline that's going on. This is not doing Zion Quinn any favors. When you look at this guy, He looks like a badass. He's got this kind of cool vibe to him, but he gets less and less cool every single week I see him as part of the storyline. This is killing this guy. They have to stop with this. Then came one of the stupidest finishes that I have seen in a long time. We had Raquel Gonzalez and Cora Jade in the main event against Io Shirai and Kaylee Ray. Now, this was the match that got changed because Toxic Attraction was not there. So they had to do something. And the stipulation they came up with is that the winners would go on to the scheduled title match in New Year's Evil against Mandy Rose, which is going to be a triple threat match. It's supposed to be Mandy Rose, Raquel Gonzalez, and Cora Jade. Instead, the winners of this match would meet Mandy. So that was the stipulation. Late in the match, Raquel Gonzalez hits the Chicona Bomb to Kaylee Ray. That's her finish. After she hits it, she kind of stumbles backwards into her own corner, and Kaylee Ray tags herself in, or not Kaylee Ray, but Cora Jade, rather, tags herself in. So Cora goes for the pin on Kaylee Ray, which would have earned both of them, her and Raquel, a spot in the triple threat match for the women's championship this Tuesday. Gonzalez, though, breaks up the pin. Or tries to. She was late, and Kaylee Ray had to get a shoulder up, so they botched it. But she goes to break up the pin. And then she starts going off on Cora Jade about, "That's my pin. You're stealing my pin away from me." I mean, she said, I couldn't believe what I was hearing here. And then, a few moments later, Kaylee Ray, she capitalizes on all this bitching that's going on by going for an O'Connor roll. And Raquel, she breaks up that pin attempt by kind of pushing her partner. She pushes Cora Jade backwards into a pinning combination of her own, and Cora Jade picks up the win for her team. So she actually, in the end, ended up helping her win the match anyway. This was a goddamn mess. This was an absolute mess. I don't know. They had to realize this going in, that this was going to play out and look completely fucking stupid. And they did it anyway. Why is Raquel Gonzalez breaking up the pin that's going to earn her and Cora Jade a championship match at New Year's Evil? What, because it wasn't her? Because she wants the pin? She came away from this looking like such a moron. You talk about dumb babyface syndrome. This was the epitome of it right here. This was so stupid. Didn't do these women any favors. So now we go into New Year's Evil coming up on Tuesday. We've got AJ Styles paying a visit to Grayson Waller. I hope he brings him some cookies. Perhaps he can bring him a pie. You know, he can go to Charlotte Flair and say, "Charlotte, why don't you bake me a pie? I'll take that pie with me. I'm going to go pay a visit to Grayson Waller this week. Give me one of those pies that you gave to Tony Storm. What is that, lemon meringue? Give me one of those lemon meringue pies." So I'm not even going to make a prediction because as far as I know, this is not even a match. Matt Riddle and MSK against Walter and Fabian Aichner and Marcel Bartel. I'm going to go with MSK and Riddle only because I think MSK is going to get the tag team title match. And it wouldn't make any sense for them to lose the six-man and still get a tag team title match. So I think that the babyfaces go over. Mandy Rose defends her NXT Women's Championship against Raquel Gonzalez and Cora Jade in a three-way. I don't see Mandy losing it here, so I think she retains. We have Roddy and Carmelo Hayes. Unification of the North American and Cruiserweight titles. This should absolutely be a win for Carmelo Hayes, and I think it will be. And in the main event, Tommaso Ciampa defends the NXT Championship yet again against Bron Breakker. Neither man was on the show this week, but they will meet for the championship. I said Bron Breakker should have won the belt in their first match, and he didn't. I'm going to say it again. Bron Breakker should win the NXT Championship here. I'm picking Bron for the win. You strap that rocket to him, and you launch him, and you see how he does. This guy is going to be on Raw or SmackDown before this year is over, so you know, give him a little run with the NXT Championship. Let him run through a few guys. See how he does. And when the time is right, you call him up because you need people like him on TV. You need people like him on Raw and SmackDown. I don't know how things are going to end up for. I mean, I have a sense of how it might end up. I'm hoping that Bron Breakker ends up being more along the lines of a Bianca Belair than a Toni Storm or a Keith Lee or a Karrion Kross. I know the odds are against him, but this man is going to be a big, big star in this company. And so now is the time to put the title on him. So that's the lineup. I am going to be live on YouTube when the show is over. So I'm going to be doing a rare NXT stream for New Year's Evil after 10 p.m. on Tuesday night. I hope you'll come on by and join me. That is not the only big event taking place on Tuesday. Wrestle Kingdom 16. It almost doesn't even feel like it because New Japan is kind of cold right now and COVID is just completely fucking everything up. Especially for them. But night one of Wrestle Kingdom is coming up on January 4th. I'm not going to read the entire card. I already did that a few weeks ago. But these are the key matches. I'll just toss in my predictions for each one. One of the cool attractions of night one is the return of Katsuyori Shibata. And he is going to be facing a mystery opponent in a grappling match. No strikes allowed. We saw Shibata have a similar type of match like this, an exhibition, I guess they billed it as, with Zack Sabre Jr. And Sabre's already got a match on the card. So it's not going to be Sabre. The question is, who are they going to put in the ring with Shibata? Just the fact that we're even getting Shibata in the ring again is very cool. But as I think of names, the only name I could really think of who would be realistic and would be a fun choice, but, you know, would also, he's a striker. Does a lot of forearm strikes, and there are no strikes in this match, would be Minoru Suzuki. I think Suzuki against Shibata would be great. There is another name who's not on either night of Wrestle Kingdom. The last we saw him, he was injured. But if he is ready to come back, the other name I was thinking about, Kota Ibushi. I just don't know what his injury status is, though, right? I think he dislocated his shoulder on that Phoenix Splash that he did a few months ago. I don't know if he's ready to come back. I think it ends up being one of those two. Suzuki is probably the likely choice. And I guess I should pick a winner. I was thinking it's not a regular match, but whoever it is, I do think Shibata picks up the win. We have Evil challenging Tomohiro Ishii for the Never Open Weight title. This feels like, if it were me, it would be Ishii going over, but I feel like Evil is going to get the win. So I think Evil wins the championship. Zack Sabre Jr. and Tai Chi take on Hirooki Goto and Yoshihashi for the IWGP Tag Team titles. I'm going with Sabre and Tai Chi. Desperado defends the junior heavyweight title against the Best of the Super Juniors winner, Hiromu Takahashi, who is going for his fifth junior title. I think he wins it. Hiromu is my pick. And in the main event of night one, Shingo Takagi defends the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship against Kazuchika Okada, the G1 winner. Shingo defeated Okada at the Dominion show in June to win the vacant title after Will Ospreay had to forfeit the belt due to a neck injury. I'm going with big match Okada here. I'm going with Okada for the win because A, it's Okada. And he's been carrying around the old IWGP belt since winning the G1. And I badly want him to reinstate that belt. So I'm hoping if he wins that that will revert back to being the official IWGP belt. But B, I'm picking Okada also because we've already had a lot of matches going back to 2019 between Ospreay and Shingo. And they are consistently match of the year candidates every single time out. In fact, that was my match of the year 2 years ago. Well, 3 years ago now. And I think it would be a fantastic Tokyo Dome main event. Don't get me wrong. But I just don't think they're going to go back to it again just yet. So I think Okada wins. And that leads into Wrestle Kingdom Night 2. We have Sanada one-on-one against Great Okan. I'm picking Sanada. Tetsuya Naito one-on-one against Jeff Cobb. I think this could be the big breakout win for Jeff Cobb. I'm going with him. Kenta defends the IWGP United States Championship against the former champion Hiroshi Tanahashi. No disqualification. Kenta won the title from Tanahashi at Power Struggle in November. We got a little tease before of Tanahashi against Jon Moxley in AEW, but it never happened. I think we are still going to get it. And Tanahashi regains the title here so that eventually we could get to a title match with Tanahashi and Moxley. And the winner of the Night 1 main event, either Okada or Shingo, will defend the IWGP Heavyweight title against the self-proclaimed real IWGP champion, Will Ospreay, who never actually lost the title. If Okada wins the title on Night 1, I think he is beating Ospreay to retain on Night 2. Which is too bad, because Ospreay was about to go on a run of great matches with that belt before he got hurt. I would have him win it back. If Okada wins on Night 1, he retains on Night 2. But if Shingo beats Okada on Night 1 and he faces Will Ospreay on Night 2, then I think Will Ospreay wins back the IWGP title. But just think about the talent they have here. In Okada, Ospreay, and Shingo, New Japan has three of the best wrestlers on the fucking planet. So you can't really go wrong with any of those three. And Shingo was the MVP of New Japan for 2021. I mean, that guy just has kick-ass match after kick-ass match. I think we're going to get a couple more. If he wins on Night 1, we're going to get a couple more of them this week. But anyway, those are my thoughts on Wrestle Kingdom. I will review both of the first two nights. Probably not Night 3. I don't know if I'm going to watch it, or when I'll watch it. But Night 2 and Night 1, I will watch. I don't know when the review is going up, and I don't know if I'm going to go live. It might just be something I record, but I promise you at some point this week, even if it has to wait until the next episode of the podcast, at some point this week, I will have a review of both nights of Wrestle Kingdom. With that out of the way, let's turn our attention to the top 15 matches of 2021. 2021 was a year that gave us a crap ton of great matches, and I have done my damnedest to condense them down to just 15. Usually I do 10. But I figure since this is the start of what's going to be the 15-year anniversary of the Sound Off, 15 years, we'll do 15 matches in rank order. Even with all the muck that WWE slung at us on its TV shows last year, and with this being a pretty cold year for New Japan, there were excellent matches in both companies, and AEW had an incredible year when it came to its in-ring product. Last year, my WWE main roster match of the year was Sasha Banks against Bayley at Hell in a Cell. That ranked number 5 on my list overall. My overall match of the year belonged to Okada against Ibushi in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom 14, Night 1. Here, we've got an extra 5 matches to squeeze in, which made it even harder for me to rank these. And I'm also going to name who I thought were the best male and female wrestlers of 2021 and what the best show of the year was as well. We'll do that a little bit later. But let's begin with number 15 on the list, and we'll work our way up to number 1. Number 15, Darby Allin versus MJF from AEW Full Gear on November 13th. If you're not on last, you want to go on first. And that's what these two did. They opened the show with an excellent match. One of the best opening matches I've seen in a very long time on a pay-per-view. Two of the young pillars of the company, MJF vowed coming in that he would win with a headlock takeover. And that's exactly what he did. He just had a little help in getting there. When the referee was distracted, you know, putting the Dynamite Diamond ring on his finger and clobbering Darby with it and then taking him over for the pin. But it was a tremendous match between the action and you know, the story, and it shut some people up who were thinking that MJF was nothing more than a promo. Now, I was still hearing that criticism from some people. The guy can cut a promo, but, you know, as a wrestler, he's okay. You know, probably because he doesn't do a lot of flashy stuff. He doesn't have to. The guy can go. He did that against Jungle Boy. He did that against Sammy Guevara, and he did that here. Here, he killed it with Darby. Number 14, Thunder Rosa against Britt Baker in an unsanctioned lights-out match from the March 17th episode of AEW Dynamite, the greatest women's match in AEW history. And that is coming from somebody who thinks these hardcore-type matches are very hit or miss. This was better than the exploding barbed wire death match that people paid to see at Revolution with Moxley and Omega. It was also a historic match because for the first time in Dynamite history, the ladies had the main event all to themselves. And I thought they knocked it out of the park. This is a match that if you saw it, you remember that image of Britt Baker, her face covered in blood, Rosa not letting up, biting away at the cut on her head, Baker being powerbombed onto the thumbtacks, still kicking out, and Rosa finishing her off with the Fire Thunder Driver off the apron, down through a table. Not only the greatest women's match in AEW history, but one of the greatest matches in Dynamite history. A bloodbath to pay off what had been a long-running feud between these two, and even in defeat, Britt Baker came out of that match a huge winner because it set her on her path to winning the women's title only a few months later. And when they come back to this match this year, and they will in the next few months come back to this match, it's going to be huge. Number 13 is the men's Money in the Bank ladder match from the Money in the Bank pay-per-view on July 18th. This was the first WWE show back in front of live fans since WrestleMania, but really the first back in front of live crowds in the post-Thunderdome era. Big E, Drew McIntyre, Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, Matt Riddle, John Morrison, Shinsuke Nakamura, and Ricochet. Morrison was a huge crowd favorite in this match, so naturally he went on to sit in the back doing meditation poses on TV for months until they fired him because they couldn't figure out a better way to utilize somebody that the fans actually gave a damn about. But he was very over on this night. This match was a lot of fun, and it may be my favorite of all the Money in the Bank matches that they've ever done. This one may be the best, and that's out of nearly 30 of them that they've done since 2005. We had Ricochet doing amazing Ricochet things. He thrives in these types of matches. And it was Big E winning the briefcase that sealed the deal. It was a very cool moment to see him get his first, really big win. I know he's been Intercontinental Champion before, Tag Team Champion. But when you win Money in the Bank, you know what that means. You know what that represents for most people who will win that briefcase. You know the odds are in your favor, that you are going to go on to win the world title. They're going to put the title on you, and which is what they did. And the crowd was ecstatic to see him pick up the win. They were genuinely happy. Now, they dropped the ball on the cash-in. It should have been a big deal, and it ended up being a Raw angle that most people are going to end up forgetting about. You know, there was a story there to tell with him challenging Bobby Lashley for the belt at SummerSlam after Lashley destroyed his buddies, but they didn't take it. Had to get Goldberg in there, so they didn't do it. But it doesn't take away from how great this match was. Number 12, Sasha Banks defending the SmackDown Women's Championship against the winner of the Women's Royal Rumble, Bianca Belair, in the main event of WrestleMania 37, Night 1, on April 10th. This was special. It was only the second ever women's main event in WrestleMania history. It was the first one to feature two women of color, which was, a big deal to a lot of people, and it was part of the story of the match. The announcers mentioned it. The reality is, if WrestleMania is a one-night event, this match does not headline over Roman Reigns. And if it doesn't headline at least one of the nights, it loses, you know, a lot of that historical significance that it had. But it did headline. It headlined Night 1. And it was a great way to close out the show. The shot of Bianca, she was starting to cry in the ring before the match even started. Sasha was fine. She was trying to keep it together. And then she looked at Bianca and she had to look away to make sure that she didn't lose it. You could tell what this meant to them. This was real emotion. And then came the match and they delivered, you know, Bianca military pressing Sasha over her head while she walked up the stairs with her. That was a great visual. The braid whip late in the match, that gunshot hair whip sounded just brutal. I loved that spot when she was doing it in NXT. So for her to bust it out in the main event of WrestleMania, it was perfect. And it looked brutal too. You had this welt across Sasha's abdomen after the match. Bianca wins with the KOD, and you see her father at ringside losing his mind. You know, not even Michael Cole's botched call at the end where he said Sasha kicked out when she did not kick out. Not even that could ruin this. Bianca was one of the NXT success stories in 2021, at least until what they did at SummerSlam. You know, winning the Royal Rumble, going on to win the title of WrestleMania. The woman is a star. And if they have any sense, she'll be back at Mania again this year to get her belt back from Becky Lynch. Meanwhile, Sasha Banks moves to 0-6 in WrestleMania matches. She's got the reverse Undertaker streak going. Number 11 is one of those matches that I thought I would never see, but I'm very happy I finally did. Bryan Danielson against Minoru Suzuki. Not even on Rampage. It aired on the Rampage buy-in on YouTube, October 15th. Tony Khan would say that it wasn't about competing with WWE that night, even though WWE was airing a supersized episode of SmackDown, the last half hour of which was directly competing with AEW that night. And then they announced that the Sasha Banks-Becky Lynch main event would be airing commercial-free, which led to Tony Khan announcing the opening match on Rampage with CM Punk and Matt Sydal would also be airing commercial-free. So Tony can claim all he wants that it wasn't about competing. That's exactly what it was. And the winners were the fans. It's like I always say, competition is a good thing. And what we got here was an all-time classic. One of the benefits of this airing on YouTube, no ad breaks during the match itself. Not like you get on Dynamite and Rampage. So everybody talking about, oh, it's on YouTube. Didn't bother me. That was the best place for it. This is when Suzuki was on his U.S. tour. He was wrestling everywhere, it seemed, including on Dynamite. But he had not stepped into a ring with Danielson since 2004. A lot had changed in those intervening 17 years. Danielson went on to become the best in the world. Suzuki got older. He turned into Murder Grandpa. So it was now or possibly never for doing this match, because once Suzuki flew back to Japan, very unlikely that AEW would ever be able to host the match themselves. You know, Danielson maybe eventually goes over to Japan to do some stuff. Maybe New Japan would do the match. But if AEW wanted it in their ring, it was now or never. And the fans treated this like a pay-per-view match. You know, you never know what you're going to get with the audience when you bring in one of the New Japan stars, if they're going to know who they are. Some people they know better than others, you know, how they're going to react to them. Are they going to get respectful applause like Yuji Nagata did? Or are they going to go batshit crazy like they probably would if Okada came in, right? Or Ibushi ever walked out on TV? The people loved Suzuki and they loved Danielson, and it made for a big fight feel. Just a fantastic 20-minute battle and a night I was very happy to be able to watch live and experience in all of its glory. I only wish I could have been in the building for it. Now we're into the top 10. And at number 10, we see our friend, Mr. Danielson, yet again. Daniel Bryan versus Edge versus Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship in the main event of WrestleMania 37, Night 2 on April 11th. Who would have thought? Two men who were forced into an early retirement due to injury would find their way back to the main event of WrestleMania. Edge won the Royal Rumble 11 years after his last Rumble win to earn the right to challenge for the championship of his choosing. But a funny thing happened along the way. Daniel Bryan, the man who was never even supposed to be in the main event of WrestleMania, ended up main eventing two of them. And it surprised even him. He told the Asbury Park Press a few weeks ago they were doing some promotion for AEW. And he said, the thing that surprised me the most this year was being inserted into the main event of WrestleMania. When I started the year, I knew my contract was ending and I was part of the creative team with WWE. And I was like, okay, what's the best thing for me to do on my way out? And it was certainly not the main event of WrestleMania. As with almost all Roman Reigns matches, we had lots of Uso interference from Jey Uso. Jimmy wasn't back yet. Edge dispatched him early on in the match. This is one of the better triple threats that WWE has done. There's a few that were better than this, but not too many. There was the memorable dueling submission spot where Edge and Roman, or Edge had Roman, locked in the crossface. Bryan applied the yes lock to Reigns, his one free arm. And then Edge and Bryan start headbutting each other to break up the holds. Edge brings in two chairs, a concerto for Bryan, but before he can deliver one to Roman, here comes Jey Uso back to the ring, and Edge takes him out, and he walks into a spear. You know, Roman Reigns with the concerto, and with that, he stacks him, he pins him, that's where his t-shirt comes from, and Roman Reigns retains his championship. This was the better of the two WrestleMania main events, and I loved the Sasha and Bianca match, but this was the better of the two matches. Outside of the Boneyard match from night one last year, this is the first time probably since WrestleMania 31 6 years ago where we had a WrestleMania main event that was good enough to make the top 10 for the year. We've had some real stinkers since 32 in Dallas, but not last year. Number 9 takes us back to the very beginning of the year and the main event of Wrestle Kingdom 15 Night 1 at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th with Tetsuya Naito defending the IWGP Heavyweight and Intercontinental titles against G1 Climax winner Kota Ibushi. It was a lot safer than the last match these two had before this. At least nobody almost broke their neck here. It was time. It was time for Ibushi to have his moment. He had a look of bewilderment on his face after Naito kicked out of that second Kamigoye. But a third one finished off Naito and gave Ibushi the double gold. Ibushi did a hell of a sell job. He was acting like he didn't even know he had won the match. He even went to try for another cover on Naito. And Red Shoes had to tell him, no, it's over. You won. You're the champion. So Ibushi gets his crowning moment. He didn't hold those titles for very long before they unified them to create a new title. And then a month after that, he lost it to Will Ospreay. He was just plagued by injury issues, Ibushi was, in 2021. Despite this win, this was not a great year for Kota Ibushi, so hopefully he'll have better luck this year. Speaking of Will Ospreay, that takes us to match number 8. Also, from the first night of Wrestle Kingdom 15 at the Tokyo Dome, Will Ospreay against Kazuchika Okada, two men who were both members of Chaos. They met months earlier in the G1 Climax with Ospreay turning heel, leaving Chaos, forming his own group called the Empire. So this was personal coming into this one. This was even better than the main event. We got big match Okada here. It had been a year since he connected with one of his Rainmaker clotheslines. He was using his shitty money clip submission. I hate that move. So it was a nice payoff seeing him hit the one Rainmaker is all it took to win this match. 35 minutes of excellence from these two men. Okada loves those long matches. You know, sometimes they're longer than they have to be. But this was just perfect. Two of the best in the world, with Ospreay getting his first big main event style match at the Tokyo Dome. And Okada delivering in that building like he always does. Number 7 is Roman Reigns against Daniel Bryan on the April 30th episode of SmackDown for the Universal Championship. The stipulation coming in was that if Bryan failed to win, he would be banished from SmackDown. His contract was legitimately up at midnight later on that same night. It turned out to be Bryan's final match in WWE, and he went out with a bang. Not with a win, but with a match that was even better than the triple threat at WrestleMania a few weeks earlier. They went nearly half an hour through three commercial breaks. This was the first of what would be several long television matches for Bryan last year, most of which happened outside of WWE. They really made this match feel like a big deal with the cut-ins throughout the night, various people offering their predictions for who would win, Rollins, Cesaro, The Miz, Nakamura. This was also the night that Roman Reigns finally debuted his new entrance music. And I thought it was weird that they waited a few extra weeks after WrestleMania to debut it. It took a little getting used to after hearing that Shield theme for, almost a decade. Now I love it. I think it suits him perfectly. It gives his entrance a very cinematic feel. For years, people clamored for Roman Reigns to change it up. New gear, new music, new moves, new everything. We finally got it with this heel run. There was no edge interference. There was no run-in by Jey Uso. No distraction from Paul Heyman to cost Bryan the match. It was a surprisingly clean win for Roman Reigns, although I guess it shouldn't be surprising given that he was on his way out. Roman put him out with the guillotine, and then after the match, set up for a concerto, which is where I figured Edge would show up, but it was Cesaro instead, since he was the one wrestling Roman at the next pay-per-view. Jey Uso ran out. They tied Cesaro in the ropes, made him watch. They made him watch while Roman gave Bryan a concerto as a going-away present. This was the best WWE match all year on free TV. I went back and forth between this one and the second match between Edge and Rollins on SmackDown from Madison Square Garden in September. I think this was slightly better, and I decided to condense the Rollins and the Edge stuff into one entry, which is actually next on my list, coming in at number 6. Edge against Seth Rollins. They had an incredible trilogy in 2021 that culminated in the best match of the series, which took place inside Hell in a Cell at their Crown Jewel pay-per-view in Saudi Arabia on October 21st. The best of all the Saudi shows they've done since 2018. That Crown Jewel show is actually a hell of a lot better than I expected it to be. Their matches got progressively better. You know, Edge and Rollins, they first tied up at SummerSlam. Things got off to a slow start, but then it picked up. It got really good. It ended up being the best match on that show. A few weeks later, the match at MSG, that one was even better. And they did an injury angle with Edge to take him off TV. That built to his return for Saudi Arabia inside Hell in a Cell. And finally, we have a rivalry worthy of the stipulation. This is the kind of feud that you blow off inside Hell in a Cell. It was also the 50th Cell match in history. It did not disappoint. One of the coolest looking table bumps that I've ever seen. And I know there's Mick Foley flying off the top of the Cell. That can never be topped. But Rollins went up top. Edge shoved him off and into the side of the cage. And Rollins bounced off the side panel and he crashed down through a table below. In the end, Edge finished Rollins off with his own curb stomp. And yes, it doesn't make much sense that Rollins is the one who just challenged last night for the WWE Championship and not Edge, who won the match. But that little detail aside, it was a fitting finale, I thought, to this trilogy. It was the best Hell in a Cell match since Sasha and Becky 2 years ago. Now we get into the top five. I have, for my number five match of the year, Will Ospreay against Shingo Takagi from New Japan's Wrestling Dontaku Night 2 on May 4th. A 45-minute classic that Kevin Kelly called the best wrestling match that he has ever called. And I want you to think for a second about the ground that that covers. As many years as Kevin Kelly has been calling big-time main event matches in New Japan Pro Wrestling, think of the ground that that covers that he calls this one the best match that he has ever called. He says, "We're prisoners of the moment. I've called Omega and Okada. I've called Tanahashi and Okada. I've called Jay and Ibushi. But this is the best wrestling match that I have ever called." That is high praise. 2 years ago, I had Ospreay against Shingo as my match of the year in 2019. That was the finals of the Best of the Super Juniors. Even as recently as March, you know, less than 2 months before this, these two hooked up in the finals of the New Japan Cup and they had another fantastic match with Ospreay going over. This time it was Ospreay's first defense of the championship that he won from Kota Ibushi. For the first, I'd say 20 or 25 minutes, they were having a really good match. You know, nothing any more or less, you know, epic than any of their other matches. Until Shingo hit the Made in Japan through two tables at ringside. And then things kicked into a completely different gear. And it turned into a clinic of hard strikes, counters, and just two men pulling everything out that they could muster to try to finish off the other. You know, it's a shame that Ospreay suffered that neck injury here and he was forced to vacate the title a few weeks later. But when these two are in the ring together, it's magic. And who knows, we may get it again this week at Wrestle Kingdom. We'll see. It could very well happen on night two. But I have this as my number five match of the year. Number four, Bryan Danielson against Hangman Adam Page for the AEW World Championship from the Winter is Coming episode of Dynamite on December 15th. On the stream that night when the show is over, I said we had ourselves a late contender for match of the year. It was only a matter of where on the list it would rank. There were only three matches I thought were better than this one. This was Hangman's first title defense after beating Kenny Omega at Full Gear, and Danielson's first big match in the heel role. If ever there was a perfect first opponent for Hangman to step into the ring with, it's Danielson. You could also tell from the pacing of this that they were going to go a long time. If Hangman showed a weakness, Brian was right there to exploit it. Like the shoulder, you know, after being posted headfirst, Hangman, he came up bloody, so he got color for some added drama. When we got up the 5-minute time call, we got the 5-minute time call from Justin Roberts, it didn't feel like 55 minutes had gone by. Now, this match never felt like it dragged. It didn't feel like it was moving like molasses or anything. At that point, you could hear Danielson shout, he's going to get his fucking head kicked in, and he started stomping away on Hangman's head. He set up for the running knee. Hangman scooped him up, hit a leaping deadeye, only got two. And from there, you know, he goes out to the apron, does Page, setting up for the buckshot lariat, propels himself into the ring. Danielson catches him, takes him down with the label lock. We got a 1 minute time cue. Hangman fights out of it, blasts him with the buckshot just as the time limit expires. We don't see many 60-minute draws anymore on TV. You know, the ad breaks, they don't really work in Iron Man matches, and they're not always a great draw for TV ratings. But these two guys put on a clinic out there, and they had the crowd, you know, into it and invested the entire time. There had to be a reason to run this match back a second time and not beat Hangman in his first defense. It was the only way to do it that didn't involve some cheap DQ or, an interference finish. Some people are just never going to accept a time limit draw as being a good finish because they're not conditioned to it. You know, they didn't grow up with it. They didn't see very many, if any, of them. Because they want a decisive winner in every single match, no matter what. But that's bullshit. You know, that's nonsense. I want a decisive winner too most of the time, but there are times where you can do finishes like this where it makes sense and it's okay and it doesn't take the match down or anything like that. It was the right finish for this match, and now we're getting the rematch on Wednesday on the first TBS Dynamite show. You know, Hangman had the match of his life out there, and Danielson did what Bryan Danielson always does. He goes out and he wrestles and tells a story in the ring, and he does it better than almost anybody else in the wrestling world. That's it. Period. End of story. Number three. You had to know that this would make the list because it was my WWE match of the year in 2020. I ranked it fourth overall in 2020. Walter defending his NXT United Kingdom Championship against Ilya Dragunov from NXT TakeOver 36. On August 22nd, their match in 2020 was held inside of an empty studio with no fans. Dragunov put up a hell of a fight, but in the end, he fell short, and Walter rampaged into 2021 as the unbeatable champion. The ultimate final boss was Walter. Well, last year, they did it again. The best WWE match all year. And they had a couple hundred people this time in the stands for it. My one regret is that none of these matches that they've had happened in front of a packed building with like 5,000 or 10,000 people like they would have had if this was like an NXT TakeOver show from 2 or 3 years ago. Like, imagine these two doing battle in New York at the Barclays Center or the Allstate Arena in Chicago like Pete Dunne and Tyler Bate did a few years ago. That's my only regret, but I referred to this at the time when I did the review. I called this a beautiful symphony of violence. Every chop that Walter threw, Dragunov would come right back. You know, Walter hit a shotgun drop kick at one point. I mean, there's a scary visual. Fucking Walter doing a shotgun drop kick. He hit the top rope splash, which is the way he beat Pete Dunne to win the title at TakeOver New York. But Dragunov kicked out. Dragunov would not quit. He got the sleeper applied. Walter tried to fight out of it. But in the end, he slayed the dragon. He did the impossible. With broken blood vessels across his neck and his chest, he ended the Ring General's 870-day reign as champion. And what a satisfying finish this was to have Walter not only lose, but the way he lost. He tapped out. They could have protected him by having him pass out. But he tapped out, a decisive win for Dragunov. This was, up to this point in the year, my match of the year for 2021. Up until August, I would have called this the match of the year. This was a battle. Everything Walter does is believable. Everything Walter does is authentic. Everything this guy does is completely believable. It feels like his opponent is in the fight of their life when they are in there with this man. Walter is just on a different level from everybody else when it comes to matches like this. I don't have a lot of hope for him on Raw or SmackDown, but if they had their wits about them, he would be the biggest heel in the company, next to Roman Reigns, by the end of this year. Number two on the list includes a familiar name that has already appeared four other times in this countdown. Bryan Danielson against AEW World Champion Kenny Omega. at the Dynamite Grand Slam from Arthur Ashe Stadium in New York City on September 22nd, billed as a dream match for the first time since 2009. As soon as word leaked out about Danielson signing with AEW, Omega had to be the first opponent for him on everybody's mind. This was the biggest night in AEW history, running New York City for the very first time, drawing its biggest crowd ever, 20,000 fans. That made it the highest attended pro wrestling event here since 1980. And the highest attended non-WWE pro wrestling show in this country since 1999, when WCW brought Monday Nitro back to the Georgia Dome for a fourth and final time. And when I say the biggest attended pro wrestling event here in New York since 1980, I'm not counting the WrestleManias in New Jersey. I know WWE loves to lump New York and New Jersey together. But to the people in New York, you don't lump us together with New Jersey. New Jersey doesn't want to be lumped together with us, and we don't want to be lumped together with New Jersey. They did the same thing in the XFL. The first go-around for the XFL back in 2000, it was the New York-New Jersey Hitmen. I don't know, something about Vince McMahon. He loves to just merge the two states together. It was Danielson's first match in an AEW ring. I had friends who stopped watching WWE years ago telling me that they were watching this match. And it was their first time checking out AEW. You know, there were two things that got them to tune into AEW. CM Punk's return in August and this match. This was special. The two of them wrestled to a 30-minute draw. The crowd was molten hot for it. Through and through. It left the door open, the finish did, for a rematch for the championship that we still haven't gotten. You know, Omega dropped it to Hangman. He went off to go heal up his injuries. I'm sure we have not seen the last of these two in the ring, whether it's for a title or not. But you cannot have a list of the greatest matches of 2021 and not have this either at or near the top of your list. It is the biggest and probably the most important match to date in AEW history. But if that was the biggest match in AEW history, then this last entry was the best all year. And it is the first time that I have had a tag team match take the top spot on my list in 5 years. Back then, I kept these lists to WWE matches only. And my match of the year in 2016 was Johnny Gargano and Tommaso Ciampa against The Revival at NXT TakeOver Toronto. For 2021, that honor belongs to the Lucha Brothers and the Young Bucks. Steel cage match for the AEW tag team titles at the All Out pay-per-view on September 5th. So many times you are in the moment with these things. To go back to the Kevin Kelly quote when he was talking about the match that I mentioned earlier in the countdown. You are in the moment in these things. A show may end and you may think, that's the best show I ever saw. That's the best match. That's the best main event. That's the best this, the best cage match. And you go back to it maybe a few weeks later, a few months later, a few years later. And it's still very good, but you don't quite feel the same way about it that you did that night, right? Because the adrenaline wears off and you're all excited. Now you've calmed down a little bit. And it's like, well, all right, maybe it's not the best, but it's still pretty good. There's a recency bias. That's what you call it. It's called a recency bias. So I wanted to go back and I wanted to watch this again to see if I still felt the same way that I did that night when the match was over and to see where it would rank on my list. It's one thing to put a list together. It's another thing to have to rank these things. So I watched it again and it was just an incredible spectacle. You know, one of the greatest tag team matches that I have ever seen. And the greatest tag team match in AEW history. People were completely sick of the Young Bucks by this point. Their antics and all of their matches had gotten old. The constant interference by Brandon Cutler and the stupid cold spray shit. They were ready to see new champions crowned. And in fact, this was the one and only title change on that entire show. So this had been building for a while. People were ready to see those two drop the belts. The Lucha Bros come out. They got the live music entrance. These can be hit or miss. This one kicked ass. I thought their entrance was fucking awesome. There were all of the crazy moves that you would expect from these two teams. They made good use of the cage, I thought, so it wasn't just there for the sake of being there. There was plenty of blood, so if you are someone who believes there should be blood in cage matches, then you were a fan of this. Matt Jackson had the thumbtack boot that they brought out in the middle of this match. Penta dove in front of his little brother to shield him. He took the bullet for him instead. They had me convinced that it was over after hitting the BTE trigger on Penta, but then Phoenix, at the last possible second, dove in to break up the pin and started his comeback. And the two older brothers locked eyes. They took out each of the younger brothers from the opposing team, and then they went at it themselves. Phoenix, you knew he would fly, and he did, off the top of the cage. And that's a fucking tall cage that they use in AEW. He comes diving off with a crossbody onto everybody. And the Lucha Bros hit the assisted pile driver to win the AEW tag team titles. The sight of Penta hugging his kids at ringside after the match, just drenched in blood. And then getting blood all over blood all over the kids. This was unbelievable. This match, in a word, was unbelievable. Everybody played their part in making this as great as it was. And as I said, one of the greatest tag team matches that I have ever seen in any promotion, the greatest in AEW. This right here was the match of the year in 2021. So when this goes up, you guys will chime in and post comments and let me know if you agree, disagree, what your list looks like, your top, doesn't even have to be top 15, but whatever your top 10 or top 5 matches of the year were. Chime in and let me know. Again, it's all subjective. This is my list, and my list might look different from yours, but it was tough to rank them. It wasn't so tough coming up with them, but ranking them is always a bitch. But I feel pretty good about the list I put together here. So now we talk about Wrestler of the Year, right? Because there were some standouts in different promotions throughout the year. The Male Wrestler of the Year and the overall Wrestler of the Year for my money in 2021 is the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson. 5 times his name appeared on that list that I just read to you. 5 times. 5 out of the 15 best matches of the year involved Bryan Danielson. So what is that? That's 33%? When you occupy that much of that list, you are the Wrestler of the Year. It is not hard to come to the conclusion that you are the Wrestler of the Year. The only other names I would have considered were Kenny Omega and Roman Reigns. Omega had lots of great matches, and he defended multiple titles across multiple promotions from AEW to Impact to AAA. And without Roman Reigns, I mean, my God, where would SmackDown be? Where would WWE be? They'd be in deep shit. That's where they would be. Because outside of Brock Lesnar, he is the biggest star they have. He looks the part. He's doing the best work of his career. But you look at the year that Danielson had, from his Elimination Chamber win to an excellent match with Roman Reigns at the Fastlane event, headlining WrestleMania for the Universal title, going out with the kind of match he had with Reigns on SmackDown. He was already in the conversation for the top spot, just 4 months into the year. Not even halfway into the year, he was already in that conversation. And then he signed with a completely different company. He went to AEW. And that was a big deal. A major name like him jumping ship and all that he brings to the table. His very first match was the key match on the biggest show in the history of AEW. He jumps from Fox to TNT and is headlining Arthur Ashe Stadium in front of 20,000 people. And since then, he has been on an absolute tear. It is the best that he has looked in years, against Omega, against Suzuki, against Eddie Kingston, against Miro, and a 60-minute Broadway with Hangman Page. This man came to AEW and he has elevated every single person that he has been in the ring with to their best matches. Winning, by the way, every single one of the matches that he has won, okay, outside of the 2 time limit draws, every match that he has won with a different hold. So he's trying to change things up. He's trying to be a little bit different. and not just go with the same, you know, the same old, same old. What sealed the deal for me is the fact that he went from being involved in the top program in WWE for the top championship there, working with the best, to doing the exact same thing in a completely different promotion in the second half of the year. He went to AEW and did the exact same thing, but he did it as a heel. For the most part. I mean, he didn't become heel until later on. I shouldn't say he did that as a heel the entire time. But in WWE, earlier this year, it was as the, you know, heroic babyface. And in AEW, he transitioned over to the heel role, and he's every bit as good, if not better. He did it as a babyface and a heel in the same year. 2021 may have been the best year of this man's career. That's saying a lot for a career that spans over 20 years. All those great years he had in Ring of Honor, some of the years he had in WWE, I think 2021 may have been his best. And you throw that three-year retirement in between. He's the best he's ever been. Shawn Michaels went away for 4 years, came back and had an incredible second half of his career. Bryan Danielson is doing the same. He went away for a while, came back, and is doing some of the best work that I've seen from him. He is the wrestler of the year. For female wrestler of the year, I have it as Bianca Belair. Came down to Bianca Belair or Britt Baker, and I went with Bianca, who has been one of the few recent success stories from NXT to the main roster. Somebody who Triple H pushed and Triple H believed in, who opened the year by winning the Royal Rumble, entering at number three, spent nearly an hour in the match, right up until that great finish with her and Rhea Ripley. She went on to headline night one of WrestleMania. Excellent match against Sasha Banks, winning the SmackDown Women's Championship. Bayley was a natural opponent to program her with until they were ready for the rematch with Sasha Banks. You put Bianca together with Bayley. And that's what they did. Her final match, though, with Bayley at Money in the Bank never happened because Bayley got hurt. Bayley got hurt because somebody got a bug up their ass and decided, you know what we want some of these main roster people to start doing? We want you to go to the Performance Center and roll. So Bayley went to the Performance Center and she was training and practicing and rolling and she fucking tore her ACL. That's almost as bad as Ember Moon chasing after the 24/7 title and popping her Achilles. So a very unfortunate injury for Bayley. And then Bianca's big rematch with Sasha never happened either because, well, I mean, we never did find out why, but Sasha wasn't there at SummerSlam. And so we ended up with Bianca losing her belt in 26 seconds. The final months of the year were spent trying to build her back up from that ridiculous angle. She had a great match on Raw with Charlotte Flair for the Raw Women's title leading into the Crown Jewel pay-per-view with a terrible non-finish that even Charlotte herself supposedly thought was a bad idea. And she supposedly was lobbying to put Bianca over and have Bianca win the belt that night. That didn't happen, but they had a hell of a match, and that led directly into Crown Jewel, very good triple threat match that Bianca was a part of, along with Becky and Sasha. Survivor Series, she overcame a 4-1 deficit to be the sole survivor for her team, and then had a surprisingly good series of TV matches with Doudrop that paid off with that just that great visual of her muscling Doudrop up onto her shoulders for the KOD a few weeks ago. So her SummerSlam booking aside, she's been more successful than a lot of other women that have been called up recently. She's the real deal. She started the year strong on SmackDown, she went to Raw, and she has really, outside of Becky Lynch, been the top woman on the show. And is somebody who should be on top for them for many more years to come. So Bianca Belair is the female wrestler of the year in 2021. The best show of the year honors belong to the AEW All Out pay-per-view in Chicago in September. It was a loaded show. CM Punk's first match officially in 7 years. And the AEW debuts of Bryan Danielson, Adam Cole, Minoru Suzuki, and Ruby Soho. All on the same night. Everything you could possibly want in a wrestling pay-per-view. This show had it. You wanted surprises? You got them. You wanted big moments? You got them. You wanted great matches? You got that too. It also claimed the award for the biggest buy rate ever for an AEW pay-per-view. They did over 200,000 buys. That was the most bought non-WWE wrestling pay-per-view since 1999. Britt Baker and Chris Statlander had an excellent match. CM Punk and Darby Allin had an excellent match. The Lucha Bros and the Young Bucks had the match of the year. Kenny Omega and Christian Cage, they had a very good match. I mean, there was no real drama around who would win, but it was still very good. And then came all of the insanity at the end, with Adam Cole coming out, kind of a swerve there. People thinking it was going to be Danielson, and then it wasn't, but then it was. This show delivered in a big, big way, more than any other show all year. And the biggest moment of the year is a no-brainer. It was the return to television after a 7-year absence of CM Punk and his AEW debut in Chicago on the August 20th episode of Rampage. The First Dance, that's what they called it. On short notice, AEW announced its debut at the United Center in Chicago. Having already sold tickets to All Out in the same market a few weeks later, they were going to run Chicago again, which is a risk. Although I guess the tickets would have already been sold for All Out. But still, I mean, they ran Chicago. Boy, they must have run Chicago, if you count Dynamite and Rampage, in like a 6-week period. They ran Chicago like, I don't know, 4 times, something, 4 or 5 times. I mean, it's always a risk to kind of oversaturate the market like that. But they announced this on short notice without announcing a single match or anything at all, really. They sold out instantly. Sold out strictly on the internet buzz and the social media buzz around the unconfirmed reports of Punk signing with the company. Over 15,000 fans packed the building. They set an AEW attendance record that stood for a month before they broke it in September. Rampage did over 1.1 million viewers on TNT, a number that show will never see again. I hope they enjoyed it, because Rampage will never see that number again. Look, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Outside of Bret Hart coming back to WWE after 12 years away, and The Rock coming back in 2011 after being gone for 7 years, I can't think of another major name that stayed away for as long as Punk did and then came back. And unlike Rock and unlike Bret Hart, he came back to resume his career full time. This was not like a one-off cameo. He wasn't back to host. He was back after being gone for 7 years. Over 7 years, 7.5. The ovation he got in Chicago was deafening. It was one of the loudest reactions I've ever heard. Punk coming back, whether it was with WWE or AEW, was always going to be a major moment. And there wasn't any single moment bigger than that one last year. Not only because of Punk himself, but just what that night in that building, you know, selling out, you know, their allotment of tickets at the United Center with all of those people, what it represented for AEW was gigantic. And that is the moment of the year. So there you go. That's your countdown, and those are your categories, all of your award winners for 2021. You guys will let me know what you think. Chime in, email me, tweet me. When this goes up on YouTube, leave comments. Don't forget, Tuesday night I'm going to be live on YouTube as soon as New Year's Evil goes off the air. I will keep you posted on what the plan is for the Wrestle Kingdom coverage. We've got the first Dynamite on TBS on Wednesday. I'll be live after that. There's going to be a lot of live streaming, almost, not every night, but almost every night this week, right on into the weekend. So follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I will keep you guys posted on everything that's going on. I've had a few people ask me about the predictions. When am I going to do the prediction show for this year? I do it every year. Right now, I'm hoping next week. I'm hoping episode 738 next Sunday will be part prediction show. I have to go back through my predictions from last year and see which ones I got right and which ones I got very wrong. But I've got a whole bunch of predictions for 2022. So the plan right now is for next Sunday. If that changes, I will keep you guys posted. But it is coming, I promise. We are going to be doing the prediction show very soon. Happy New Year. Thank you for all the love and all the support. I hope you will join me on this journey through 2022, as many of you did last year. Keep spreading the good word. Let other people know about the show. Share. You know, that's the best way to support the show, is to tell friends and tell other people about it. And I will be back for episode 738 next Sunday. I believe that is January 9th. Be well, stay safe, and join me all this week for all the live coverage on YouTube. Some Sound Off Extra. You got a lot of it coming your way this week. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monsters Sounds Off.
You know, they try to portray this NXT 2.0 relaunch as, like, it's hip and it's cool. And they have that voiceover guy every week. And he runs down the card. And then he goes, yeah, it's like that. And I'm like what? Is that supposed to be cool? He sounds like the fucking father who's trying to be cool for his son. You're not cool. Nobody thinks you're cool. Your show is not cool. Stop trying to be cool. Yeah, it's like that. Fuck off.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.